Colleagues, friends, it is a great pleasure to welcome Professor Nabil Matar from the University of Minnesota, together with Professors Gottfried Wettinger and Franz Chapara, and Dr. Marco Gallia from our own university, for this roundtable conference on historical and fictional narratives of slaves in North Africa and Malta. We will be starting off with the individual speakers' contributions, followed by questions and comments from the floor bearing on the evening's topic. Both roundtable and floor sessions will be chaired by Professor Arnold Cassola. Marco Gallia's paper examines literary devices of traditional Maltese novels that put an unbridgeable gap between Maltese virtues on the one hand and the Turkish villain's depravity, comprising his murderous, vandalizing and raping ways on the other. In this literary world, how do Turkish slaves fare under Maltese masters? And conversely, how do Maltese slaves feature in Turkish bondage? Literary narratives intervened into history, Marco argues, to counter a condescending colonialist attitude towards the Maltese people by fabricating a deeply religious and intrinsically virtuous Maltese character in typical contrast to the supposedly depraved Turk. This, he points out elsewhere, amounted to dabbling in racism and racial hatred on the part of Maltese writers as an attempt to become part of the racial and racist discourse that would satisfy the entry requirements into a Western hierarchy, a literary strategy undone by more recent post-independence writers. Franz Chapara's contribution concentrates on 17th century accounts given to the inquisitors by Christian captives upon their escape from a life of bondage and apostasy. Far from being ideological or piously thankful towards divine intervention, these accounts focused entirely on the captive's personal drama in Ottoman lands, including the outward renunciation of his faith as an expedient for survival. Important historical documents though they are, these accounts display the narrator trying to save his skin through narrative technique. Franz will be examining the extent to which such narratives were believed by the inquisitors, especially at a time when it was accepted that the Christian captives' best chances of survival lay in becoming a dissimulating renegade within a world of porous borderlands. Franz will also be talking on the lenient sentences meted out by these inquisitorial sittings, implying thereby a Mediterranean mindset tolerating apostasy as a pragmatic option for captives, Christian by belief and Muslim by compulsion. Nabil Matar's paper on British captives focuses primarily on their numbers between the dates 1578 and 1727, a time span comprising, among other momentous encounters between Europe and North Africa, Britain's new ascendancy over the Mediterranean. Of primary interest in Nabil's paper is his argument that superior naval technologies enabled the British and the French to assume the role of defenders of their subjects from the Barbary corsairs, while in effect destroying North African fishing, trading and privateering fleets to an extent that would eventually make the region dependent on British and French ships for travel, pilgrimage, commerce and navigation. Nabil's fundamental questions caution us against taking accepted historical causes at face value. How many British captives were there in reality in North African bondage? Did their true numbers justify a war, or were they exaggerated to serve as a pretext for hostilities, bringing about British dominance in the region? Nabil thus questions an accepted historical mindset that had long and purposefully enhanced the picture of countless British captives in North Africa. Godfrey Whittinger's accumulated research on slavery in Malta, on the relation between Maltese place names and the personal names or nicknames of Arabs, and of course on the issue of continuity or lack thereof in Maltese history during the last 1,000 or so years, hardly needs introducing. Constantly coming back to these topics with renewed verve and thrust, he has guaranteed us a lively and ongoing historical debate. The impressive historical background that Godfrey's name has now come to stand for will undoubtedly be informing his reconsiderations this evening of that aspect of our medieval history concerned with the captivi and Abida as supposed survivors of massacres, exilings, and other causes of depopulation in 870 AD. Let me just pose a couple of questions to tease your curiosity as to where these reconsiderations might lead. Do other historical sources corroborate Commendatore Abela's careful distinction between the captivi freed by Count Roger and the Maltese survivors supposedly found at Mijra Ferha? Against the few that the Abida featuring in Muslim documentation are proof of the existence of Christian survivors of the struggle of 870 AD, what alternative connection might there have been between the Abida and the corsairs with their captives? And how does a piece of gold coinage come into the lucrative picture of ransoming these captives? So there's a topic that promises a lively debate for you. It is not merely the theme of slavery that makes up this evening's conference, but more importantly, the way historical, personal, and fictional accounts come together at such a meeting ground as the subject of slavery. This calls to mind Paul Ricoeur's wonderfully termed notion of the conflict of interpretations that occurs between different documents of life. That is, the way documented articulations of the human condition initially confront one another until they interweave into a meaningful gestalt within the humanities. To host this encounter between different discourses from the humanities is part of an ongoing effort by the Department of Maltese to serve as a platform for scholarly views in dialogue. Before I invite the speakers to give their talks, allow me one last word of thanks to Adrian Grima for coordinating today's talks and for being the architect of this conference's setup. When it comes to organizing such debates, Adrian is, as I have said on another occasion, the usual suspect. I invite Arnold to chair the first session, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much, Bernard, and thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I'm sure that we will be missing the football match between Turkey and Greece, but I'm sure we will make up for it with a very interesting four talks here with our speakers. Slavery is something we have lived with, and unfortunately, in the past, and something, unfortunately, which we are living with in the present, with so much child labor, child soldiers, trafficking of women, trafficking of human beings for the sale of human organs. So it seems to be something of the past, but actually, when we look around us in the world, we see that it is really something which is very, very actual, something very, very belonging to the present. And in Maltese past, we have fiction and history. It has been part and parcel of our historical and cultural, I would say, heritage. If we look at literature, just thinking of literature, our poetry is full of the metaphor and the simile and the comparison and whatever to slavery, Lilsira, Lilsir, etc. If we look at our historical novels, and Dr. Galia will be will be developing this topic. Just think of all, you know, José Muscadazzo Pardi, Ines Farrugh, by Caruana, José Aquilina, Tahlet Saltni. The figure of the slave is always there, or is very much to be found. And also in poetry, apart from the imagery, just imagine of one topic which really dominated in the 18th century, Maltese poetry, the famous uprising by Mustafa Pasha of Rhodes, Mustafa Bassatarodi, with having so many poems and so many books written about it in Maltese literature. And going back to history, of course, this has been part of our life, of our nation's life. Of course, there have been people who have survived slavery and went on to become famous in their lives. Just think of Lavalette, who spent so many number of years as a slave in North Africa and ended up where he is now. Now he's a part of our mythology. Think of a minor person, not much well known, Marcello Attardo de Vagnoli, who was a poet in the 17th century. He wrote a whole canzoniere in Italian. He's a Maltese. He wrote 365 days, one poem for each day, modeled on Petrarca. He spent 8 years as a slave in Tunisia. And finally, to conclude before we start off with our first speaker, I just mention four slaves who I met in my research during my recent research on the Maltese community living in Trapani in the 15th century. There are at least 50, 55 Maltese, at least four of whom had to do with slavery. It was a big economic activity. It generated a lot of money. It provided employment for people too, as you will see. Not for Rogerius Maltensis, the husband of Pina and Petruccus, both of them Maltensis, who was taken prisoner in Terra Barbaria in 1438. So he must have been around in Tunisia, somewhere around those areas. Another Maltese, for example, Paulus Carcugi Maltensis, in 1428, acted as a go-between. He used to ransom slaves, basically. So in Trapani, a noble woman, Beatrix de Tomeus, de Giraki, sorry, her husband was taken as a slave in North Africa. This Beatrix, who must have been quite rich, bought two Saracen slaves in Trapani, handed them over to this Maltese, Paulus Carcugi, and he was going to try and mediate and exchange them for her husband in North Africa. Carcugi must have been quite lucky. Another lucky person, in the sense that he was not a slave, but the owner of a slave, was a Franciscus Formusa, who used to live in Syracuse, always in 1430 this time. But he went to court in Trapani, because a nobleman from Trapani, Andreas de Carofalo, stole his slave, a certain Mahmet de Tabulba, and therefore they went to court on the ownership of the slave. And the final chap, to remind, another Maltese, remember, is Antonius de Lupilatu, known alias Mantensis in these notarial archives, who had bought una schiava nigra by the name of Misuda, and this is quite tenero, I can send the image which I see, una nigra nomine Misuda, cum figlia lactante anni uno. He bought this woman slave with her lactante, one-year-old little baby who was still, with her mother and so on. He bought them from Braconius Dulupresti of Mazara del Vallo for 15 onze d'oro. That's enough on my part, and I think we can start off with the first talk. It will be the slaves and Maltese literature, and I invite Dr. Marco Gallia to take the floor. I think we should be using that one. I have been told it should be better, right?
My presentation this evening will focus on some short novels written by José Muscadazzo Pardi towards the end of the 19th century. The choice to discuss these works has not been dictated by any great literary merit these works have, but by their place in Maltese literary history, which, as we all know, is not the same thing. Instead, the argument I will try to make will depend on some of the political aspects put forward by the texts. José Muscata Zopardi was active as a writer during the last three decades of the 19th century and the first two decades of the 20th. By then, British colonialism had consolidated itself into the only system of government the Maltese people could perceive as feasible. It was also the period characterized by the almost unending language question, which started off as a battle for hegemony between the old school professional classes and the new rulers and the acolytes. The fact that Maltese ended up being one of the winners in this battle has something to do with our story, and we might come back to it. At his death in 1927, Muscat Zopardi was hailed in Parliament, no less, as the father of Maltese literature. It is clear from what was recorded that this evaluation was based mainly on Muscat Zopardi's ideology, and not on literary value. The author earned his title, which has stuck, because he expressed values which the political class could subscribe to. To put things into perspective, the novelist Anton Manuel Caruana had been dead for some time. His novel Inés Farrugh had already gone into several editions by Muscat Zopardi's death, and it is generally considered by more recent literary critics to be far superior to anything Muscat Zopardi ever wrote. Oliver Frigieri, for example, sees it as the first novel in Maltese to have literary value. This would mean that Muscat Zopardi's novels we are discussing here, both published previously, are not considered to have this value. And yet, their author's influence on the development of literature and political thought in Malta remain great. All José Muscat Zopardi's novels focus on the relationship between the Maltese and their others. He tells narratives set in the past, choosing mainly those episodes which his Maltese readers would feel proud of as they showed their ancestors victorious against much stronger powers. Therefore, the main aim of Muscat Zopardi's fiction is to create a corpus of works which creates a belief among the Maltese that they are worth something, and that if the need arises, they will find within them a strength that is not obviously apparent. This issue is central as it is one of the most commonly used reactions to colonialism during the 19th and the 20th century. In Muscat Zopardi's fiction, the Maltese are always contrasted to foreigners. However, there are two types of foreigners. The Europeans, who are generally seen as Christians who have lost their way, and the Turks, who represent everything that the Maltese are not. They are non-European, non-white, and non-Christian. Their presence is essential for most of José Muscat Zopardi's work. They are both the antagonist and the point of reference for discourse about race. So the Turk is both the cruel enemy and the guy we would not like to be. Very conveniently, the Turk can show that not only are we Europeans, something the British colonizers were not always sure of, but also that we have defended European interests against Muslim aggression in the past, just as British colonialists claimed to be working in the interests of Christianity when they took over large areas in Africa and elsewhere. Which brings us to the slave. The Turkish slave, there's one thing I'm sort of glossing over. When Muscat Zopardi uses the word Turk, he means anyone who's from Tunisia downwards, basically. So he could be any type of Muslim, any type of black. It's a very confusing idea, which is also something that other writers of his generation do. The Turkish slave in Muscat Zopardi is almost always captured during fighting or as a result of wars. At the time he was writing, slavery had been abolished for decades, so he probably felt that he had to justify somehow why the Maltese, whom he presents as a morally exemplary race, ever kept slaves. In fact, not only are the slaves captured because they were at war against the Maltese, but like the case of Hamid Zuta in Tone Bayada, they are even saved from certain death by the Christians themselves. Almost as if to say, slavery is not such a high price to pay, especially, as is always the case, the Maltese owners are so benevolent that they invariably treat their slaves very well, almost as members of their own family, and grant them freedom after a few years, and the ex-slaves are allowed to return home or live freely among the Maltese. This contrasts sharply with the way Maltese slaves are treated by their Turkish masters. Tony Bayada, when he was captured, was beaten, chained, spat at, even mutilated. The only thing that cannot be taken away from him is his flower, hidden capably inside his trousers as a sign of his undivided devotion to his bride, whom he had left stranded on their wedding day. Yes, and there's a counterpart to this narrative when his bride is captured by the Turks. It is quite clear that she was the flower, but anyway. His slavery could only come to an end when he managed to escape, because after all, the Turks are also a bit dull, and their slave drivers tend to fall asleep with the keys to all the slave chains within easy reach. This is also a motive that's quite common in Maltese literature. For example, in Giuseppe Colina's Tahtlet Saltnit, there's an episode where a Turkish slave just crops out of nowhere and is saved by Gianni and a French knight, and these Christians ridicule him and his religion because he's stupid. He just happens to be stupid because he's a Turk. In short, the Turkish slave in Giuseppe Mascarazzo-Pardi's fiction only exists as part of the equation where the Maltese need to have enemies, and these enemies need to suffer some consequences. The main issue, therefore, is not slavery itself, but the enmity between the two peoples. The Maltese hate the Turks as much as the Turks hate the Maltese. The two examples I will now try to discuss in some detail point to the same ideological position. A Turk should never be trusted, and there should be no attempt on behalf of the Maltese to build bridges. Slavery is the natural condition that the Turk should find himself in, if there is to be any justice. In a discussion between the hero Tony Bayad and his best mate Gianni, the Turks are defined twice as Gens Ilyasar, or the race of slavery, and this, in the hero's opinion, explains the Turks' behavior. Hamid Zuta is the easier character to deal with. He is the bad guy who, despite being treated generously by the Maltese, waits patiently for an opportunity to cause as much harm as possible to the community. When he is freed, instead of returning to his homeland, he stays on and works on the trust he gains to strike at the right time. Secretly, he kills Tony's mother and kidnaps his bride. No details of her imprisonment are given, except that she was kept in a cave for 2 years, fed on black bread. All this happens while the rest of the community is convinced that he has become one of them. The price for this ultimate reason is public hanging, and the body is thrown to the dogs, in a novel where the word dog is used only in the context of members of the two nationalities trading insults at each other. The reader of this novel, like Tony Bayada himself, is bound to conclude that all this could have been avoided if the Turkish slave had been treated like a slave and not given the liberty to plot against the Maltese. In 1883, Mascarazzo-Pardi published Susanna, a novel set, like Tony Bayada, during the Great Siege. Actually, the narrative starts before, but it's mainly set in the Great Siege. Here, the slave does not fit so easily into the role of the antagonist. In fact, given the attributes he is endowed with in the novel, I would like to refer to him as the Good Turk. The first time the as yet unnamed Turk appears in the novel is in Chapter 3, when he saves the eponymous hero from a gang rape. This favor is returned when he is being mobbed by an angry crowd of Maltese men after being caught spying, but is saved by Susanna, who recognizes him. The death penalty he deserves for his crime is commuted to a life in slavery, and he is entrusted to the girl by his captor as a token of his as yet undeclared love. This slave is no more than a toy that can be dispensed with. In fact, Muscazzo Pardi declared, "Dak iż-żmien kien ġieħ kbir lill-kbarat Maltin ikollhom xi tork irsir tagħhom u kienu jħallsu flejjes kbar biex jirnexxielhom iħasslu xi wieħed, l-aktar imbagħad meta kienu jaqbdu huma nfushom xi priża li jagħmlu bil-ħila tagħhom." In those times it was an honor for the well-established Maltese to have a Turk as their slave, and they would pay good money to acquire one, more so when they could claim to have captured them, him themselves. It's like a prize you manage to hunt and to put in a showcase or something like that. Now this is where the trouble starts. The slave falls in love with his beautiful mistress, something which makes sense considering her attitude and her beauty, which is of course described in Northern European values. It is a topos in Western European literature, as well as in Orientalist painting, that the Oriental, the Turk, is shown as a lustful man. The harem has always been a hard pill to swallow for male writers, but worse than that is the thought of the non-European male gazing at or lusting after European women. Our 19th century literature is riddled with examples of Turk who set out to seduce or rape Maltese women. As early as Luigi Rosato's 1839 Caterina, this theme is shown as one of the main differences between Maltese men and foreign ones. The Maltese are always portrayed as being monogamous, the foreigners promiscuous and lustful. Which brings us to another issue. Almost all slaves mentioned in Muscazzo Pardi's novels are male. Females in Muscazzo Pardi's novels are intrinsically connected to family and religious values, so it would have been hard to reconcile his idea of woman with his idea of slave. His vision is cleaner. The slave being foreign and male is dangerous. There is no place in his world for female slaves to be redeemed by merciful men, like there is, for example, in José Colina. His world is static, where you're either born Maltese, that is on the right side of the fence, or you aren't, and there can be no crossing over from one side to the other. To come back to our enamored slave, his passion for his mistress is controlled. In fact, he behaves in an honorable way all along, accepting that his love can never be returned simply because he is a Turk and a slave. And yet his presence leads to tragedy anyway, when his mistress is killed by her fiancé by mistake. So even though the Turk doesn't do anything wrong, the fact that the Maltese are in some way engaged with him, they have contact with him, spells disaster for all of them. Muscazzo Pardi believed in a world where everyone had his place. His writing is an attempt to find a place where his compatriots could fit into the colonial project without being too uncomfortable. For this plan to succeed, however, he had to make sure that a complete mental separation could be made between the Maltese and the hated Muslims. If this meant portraying the Turks as deserving to be slaves, it was a small price to pay.
Thank you, Dr. Gallia. I think you have given us a very good presentation of the Muslim in general, known as the Turk, but it's actually referring to the Muslim in the Maltese literature. And I think we have a remnant in our language of this cliché of hatred and opposition which we have had during the centuries, where we still have quite a number of expressions today in Maltese which still mention the Turk in general. So we pass on now to our second speaker, Professor Chappara, who will be speaking to us about slaves, converted slaves, in the 17th century. Thank you very much.
Conversion narratives and the Roman Inquisition in Malta, 1650-1700. The phenomenon of apostasy from Christianity to Islam started to be studied only recently, not so much because of lack of documentation, as perhaps for the inability to discover and admit a disquieting past. My attention was first drawn to these renegades when reading their narratives to the inquisitors on their arrival in Malta. But before embarking upon an examination of the evidence, it is pertinent to observe that these narratives were not put to writing as a result of some personal crisis that motivated their authors to seek psychological refuge through the therapy of autobiography, nor were they intended to be recorded for posterity. The reason for their existence was a simple one, the requirements of canon law. Apostates, like all heretics, besides being reconciled by confessors in the court of conscience, had to be forgiven also in the exterior court of the inquisitor. It was only in this way that sacramental and oral confession was transformed into a written denunciation by the clerk of the Inquisition. Such narratives had no ideology behind them. They were not part of apologetic discourse. Neither did they intend to show God's providence in freeing Christians from slavery, nor did they try to demonstrate the superiority of Christianity over Islam. The narrators focused mainly on the strictly personal aspects of their drama, how they found themselves on Ottoman lands, their experience in captivity, their release or escape, but especially the circumstances that surrounded their apostasy. What kind of stories did they tell the inquisitor? Did the church judges believe everywhere they said? Were they sincere in their apostasy, or were they still committed to their religious and national identity? If so, how did they survive among a hostile Muslim population? What aspects of their mental and spiritual world can be apprehended in their narratives? In what ways do they make us penetrate their imaginative world? And how much can they help us understand of religion and society in early modern Europe? This study emerges from a desire to understand all these queries. We can start our analysis by referring to the enormous number of Christians who defected to Islam, just as so many Muslims embraced Christianity in Christendom. News regularly reached Malta that a Christian had abandoned his faith. I quote, "I received this letter, which tells of the apostasy of Alonso, the son of Damiano. Benedetto Calleo Vittorioso reported in 1653 to Inquisitor Federico Borromeo. As to their exact numbers, we cannot say, but the Benessars, in their beautiful book, full of warmth and understanding, Le Chrétien d'Allah, identified 1,500 apostates between 1550 and 1700. But this may well represent 0.5% of the total. But did these apostates ever return to Christianity? Ambrogini counted 922 of them who appeared before the Holy Office in Malta between 1577 and 1670. This is a huge number, but the table is still more surprising because in 1650 through 1700 they totaled 534. And this is by no means the whole lot. Some renegades revealed their defection only when they lost all hope of being ransomed. Other slaves were prevented by their masters to present themselves at the Holy Office, lest they would be set free. Lastly, Urban VIII in 1637 gave the missionaries in the Levant power to reconcile apostates, who therefore had no need to appear before the Inquisitor. Not only do these apostates impress with their number, but they hailed from all over Europe and Asia. Most were Maltese, Greeks, Russians, French, Italians, Spanish and Turks, and there were even Hungarians, Poles, Dutch, and Englishmen besides others. It must be observed that very few of them were women, only 38 or 7.1%. Being the weaker sex, they were more inclined to apostatize, but they would have found it more difficult to escape, and their chances of being ransomed were less too. Moreover, they would be generally married, dedicated to their husbands and children. These apostates were often enslaved while fighting the Turks at sea. Others were caught in military engagements on land. We must also take account of widespread slave raiding in frontier zones, when marauding parties like the Cossacks and Tartars abducted so many Georgians and Circassians to sell them at Constantinople. Here we should include the tribute children of the Afshulma, who joined the Janissaries. But before we continue with our analysis, a historical problem draws our attention: the textual analysis of narrative sources. Social and cultural historians have used trial transcripts to recover voices from the past. One of the best-known examples of these microhistories is Carlo Ginzburg's The Cheese and the Worms. But do these transcripts faithfully reproduce what the defendant narrated? It must be emphatically underlined that they do, despite Nick Davis's misgivings. In confirmation of this, in 1626, the cardinal inquisitors demanded that the reports sent to them should be in the very words of the witnesses and of the defendant. Even so, though the clerk did not tamper unnecessarily with the defendant's accounts, court records are fraught with methodological problems. We should be aware lest we be charged of complacency and reductiveness. Tales cannot be dislocated from the circumstances in which they were told, and we should give importance to the contexts in which our historical figures speak. To put it then in the form of a question: how did apostates try to save their neck by a story? Most, of course, presented their case as part of a survival strategy and drew on a rhetoric of ill-treatment. Sometimes Christians skillfully tried to create the impression that they defected suddenly in the face of a crisis, say, having relations with a woman. Apostates presented themselves also as the victims of circumstances, being seduced by the concubines of their master. At least, this is what they said. But just here, we have to be very careful, because could church judges have been so gullible not to realize that these anecdotes could contain half-truths and lies and be populated with the intentions of the storytellers? Did they not realize that the 17th century Mediterranean was a world of porous borderlands, where the renegade and especially the dissimulator best survived? Or that these apostates may have drawn on tried and tested methods to represent their case in the best possible light. Possibly they did not enter their heads that the men and women in front of them were not innocent of storytelling skills, sacramental confession being an important preparation for them to tell their misdeeds. Could the church judges have been so naive as to believe apostates who went corsairing against Christians, I quote, in the hope of being caught and reach Christendom? How much weight did these stories carry? Is it hard to suspect that these unfortunates dramatized their predicament? Did they not realize that there was nothing else for them to do but to tell the inquisitor what he wanted to hear? The question that should be the focus of our attention here is whether the church judges were fooled. Quite the opposite. Inquisitors were well-qualified men, foremost jurists, of which they boasted so much. They were also helped in their decisions by their consultors, chosen from among the most learned and esteemed men of the island. They also availed themselves of their printed and manuscript law books, besides consulting their archives, which constituted a form of perpetual and unfailing memory. Above all stood the cardinal inquisitors at Rome, to whom their representatives turned frequently for advice. The inquisitors, in fact, often remained skeptical and dismissed the apostates' reasons for forsaking Christianity, inserting the words, come di cesti, as you said in the sentence. They were conscientious judges, and it could take many months, years even, before the sentence was laid down. Inquisitors handed down three types of sentences. 116 of the apostates were only made to make a profession of faith. Most of them resembled Guerre of Castelnuovo in Albania. He was still in his swaddling clothes when his parents died and was brought up by a Muslim woman who circumcised him at the age of 6. But if this is an example of an individual who found himself accidentally in the opposite fold, we must realize that the religious frontier that separated the Christian from the Muslim world was permeable. Take the case of Malta and the Barbary Regencies. They still preyed on each other's shipping, but instead of being two irreconcilable enemies, they were economically interdependent and traded with each other regularly. Far from being a barrier, the Maltese frontier played the part of a living membrane, a trading frontier. Its bastions, as Ballard has said for medieval Kaffa, were only a symbolic boundary. They were formidable and awe-inspiring, but they were porous to every influence. The reasons for Christians to embrace Islam were several: to enjoy the much publicized sexual license of the Muslims, to be relieved of debt and the ill-treatment on ships, to be liberated from an unwanted spouse, or to escape the rigors of the law. Brodel assures us that at the presidios, or coastal forts, virtually places of deportation, life could be so unbearable that soldiers would desert for Islam too. The greatest followers of the Turkish dream, though, were those Christians who felt that Christian society had been unjust to them and condemned them to a life of misery. I quote, "What are we doing here among this canaille?" Pietro of Pantelleria asked the Maltese Giuseppe of Bulmola in 1698. He proposed to him to escape on a boat to Tripoli, where we shall derive great gain. At home, these people lived on a pittance, but in Muslim lands, they would earn their living with ease, reaching perhaps the highest positions in the state. Several apostates were engaged in corsairing. Fighting the Christians was a form of social resistance or revolt, since it offered opportunities, especially to Europeans from the poorer regions of the Mediterranean coastline, to release their hatred of their former co-religionists by taking pleasure in enslaving them. One of these embittered former Christians, the enemy of his own civilization, who fits an observable pattern in apostates down through the centuries, was the Maltese Francesco Borch of Bricircaia. His story was that he dreamed of going to Barbary, where he would become a gentleman, grand'uomo, esteemed and honored by all. He assured one Giovanni Battista Maniscalco that he would lose his fortune if he did not accompany him. He even intended to make his way to Constantinople to throw himself at the feet of the Grand Turk. He would then turn his navigational skills against his former compatriots, harassing the coast of Malta and wreaking vengeance on those who had denied him justice. Francesco Perez was another one of those who made a decisive break with the past and drifted away from the observance of Christian customs. He was proud of and open about his defection. In 1655, he wrote a letter to his wife, telling her, "Thank God, I have become a Muslim, and I would like to live and die in this faith, if God so pleases." When brought before the Inquisitor, these former Christians stood their ground well and brought out their wild stubbornness. "I don't want to curse the sect of Muhammad, nor do I want to return to Christianity. I want to remain a Turk." Even so, only a handful of the 534 renegades in our sample were declared former heretics by the Holy Office, 12 altogether, or 2.2%. None of them was consigned to the secular arm, but since, I quote, "you said that you have repented and asked mercy and forgiveness," they were absolved from excommunication. As penitents, they were condemned to wear all their life the penitential garment, the abitello San Bino, adorned with the signs of the cross. They were also punished with life imprisonment in the dungeons of the Inquisition, though they could be sent instead to row on the galleys. The greatest number of apostates, 406, or 76%, were found guilty only of suspicion of heresy, whether lightly, da levi, or vehemently, da vehemently. In fact, the recrossing into Christendom was not at all traumatic, and unlike the Maranos and Moriscos, apostates were neither despised nor ostracized. Two intriguing points are of interest to us here. First, are not Christians to be testimonies to their faith until martyrdom? What considerations, then, may chair judges moderate their rigor? This is a disquieting remark. The motives were various. The inquisitors must have realized that some of these cases presented genuine stories of apostates having had to succumb to Islam. Take the case of Matteo Abela, alias Recep. On 15 September 1562, he informed his most dear mother at Burmula that a misfortune had happened to him. He had been charged of killing a Muslim, for which he apostatized, not to be sentenced to death. But, I quote, and this is part of the letter, he told his mother, "I will never abandon the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, and I will take the first opportunity to escape. Don't be disheartened, but pray God and his mother, the Virgin Mary, to help me return to the land of the Christians, where I can die in the Christian faith." Besides, the Santo Officio wanted to allow the greatest number possible of apostates to re-enter the Church rapidly and easily. Did not their arrival in Christendom mean that the enemy restored the soldiers, sailors, specialists of every kind, unwillingly ceded to him? And would not the defectors who returned home furnish information about the military armaments of the enemy? Furthermore, was not their escaping to Christendom with the thousand dangers these unfortunates braved a sign of their attachment to their old faith? Lastly, there was an overriding theological motive for the inquisitors' leniency. Islam did not frighten the inquisitors as a religion. Understandably so. Basic to this argument is that if Christianity is committed to exclusive commitment, everything depends on what faith means. This is decisive. Crimes against the faith, inquisitors were instructed by their manuals, do not consist in words or deeds, but in the mind and the will. Whoever apostatizes as a result of violence or threat of death, but preserves faith in his heart, is only an external apostate. And though warned of his wickedness, he must be welcomed benignly in the bosom of the Church. The point here is that if it is accepted that faith is only an interior and individual intention, it is very easy to preserve it in hostile circumstances with a strategy of dissimulation. Antoine Mistral, a Frenchman living in Malta, had no doubt at all about this kind of conversion he had undergone. In 1651, he told Inquisitor Cavalletti that his apostasy had been only apparent, quella apparente apostasia. This admission suggests two key insights. It implies that sincerity of conversion must not have unduly occupied the Ottomans. Mistral's confession also proves that despite their deviant outer behavior, apostates were still part of the Christian community. Their being Muslims consisted simply in reciting the formula of abnegation, as well as in dressing like them and eating their food in those 7 months I stayed at Tripoli. What counted, therefore, for Pierre Porcel, as for other several apostates, was not outward appearances or the conversion rite, but that "I have never believed one can save one's soul in Islam." The slave of Baron Pietro Cassia put it even more pertinently. He told Inquisitor Angelo Ranucci in 1667 that there is no salvation outside the Christian Church, but I think apostasy on the exterior is licit, on condition that one keeps the Christian faith in one's heart. Conversion is an interior and individual act. External behavior has no religious value and can be easily interpreted as a sort of cultural mimicry or mental reservation. To use the heavy phrase coined by David George Mellon, we can call these apostates outsiders inside. Lastly, how can deceit and compromise be explained? Perhaps we can refer to a seminal paper published by John Bossi in 1975. He made us realize that in the period between the 15th and the 17th centuries, confession lost its social dimension. If formerly it had been a means to preserve peace in the community, it now became interiorized, symbolized by the Borromean confessional. Sin was primarily considered as something which occurred in the mind, so that hatred was replaced by individual sexuality as the chief sin. It was the dawn of individualism, when man, in the Dockerbin's words, was imprisoned within the solitude of his own heart. To conclude, our apostates, who all ended in being readmitted to the Church, were not unaware of how best to make their case to the inquisitors, and chose which parts of their life history to tell them. They were kindly welcomed by the inquisitors, though, because despite their deviant outer behavior, most of them still looked upon themselves as part of the Christian community. They were Muslims against their own selves, who only impartially adhered to the new religion, while the most crucial part of their identity, the heart, remained Christian. A passage in an anonymous manuscript, written in 1615 by a Morisco in Algiers, bears this out, I quote, "We have reason to believe the greatest part of them are as unbelieving as those who begot them." Their conversion was not a defection or a change of allegiance, but a matter of accommodation. They made significant adjustments, but these were acceptable compromises that did not seriously undermine their continuing commitment to Christianity. We still continued to occupy their thoughts. Like Rocco Cassaro Valletta, a slave in Algiers in 1617, they ever hoped in God soon to escape and return to Malta. Unlike heretics who diverged from Christianity in their beliefs, they were apostates only in their actions. They preserved their Christian identity behind an artificial mask of Muslimness. Or to put it in the words of Valentin Vega, they led the outer man, followed the Islamic law, while the inner man worshipped God purely. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Chappara. I think when we look at this paper, it gives quite a bleak picture of humanity, because you get the impression that many of these apostates were actually opportunists, converting, you know, to see whether it was for a better quality of life. I don't know, it might be an impression or it might be a wrong impression. Anyway, so we pass on to our next speaker. It's now Professor Mataf, who will be speaking about British slaves, more or less, in North Africa during the 17th century, 18th century. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm both honored and pleased to be here. This is my first visit to Malta. Honored because, you know, the university and the Department Maltese and Adrian have all come together with the chair and other members of the department to put together this panel, and I'm really excited to be here, particularly with Professor Wettinger, who was my first introduction to the studies of Maltese slaves. My dear friend Alex, years ago, told me about Professor Wettinger's book, which I bought, and I realized this is a place I need to learn about by far more. I'm so pleased to be here. I'm so grateful that you're here. I particularly want to thank my friend Alex and his wife Maya, who made my visit possible here. They encouraged me to come and visit. I've loved the place in the past week, and I hope to be here again. I'm sure they're worried about that, but I hope to be here again next year. Thank you so much. Malta and Britain share one thing in common, which is that they're islands. But the methodologies that the Maltese seem to have had regarding captives is very, very different, unfortunately for Britons, from that in Britain. And my paper, the issue about problems, is perhaps something that may not have arisen as widely in Maltese studies as they are in British studies. So that's why we focus on this issue. British captives in North Africa have always attracted attention from historians and literary critics. But the issue of captivity has not been dissociated from religious polarization and in the post 9/11 world from political and racial categorization. Perhaps the first study about British captives, published in 1884, set the tone about the captivity studies. Robert Lambert Clifford's The Scourge of Christendom. That was the title of his book, and it tells you the kind of mindset that he had. In the past half a century, the discourse has not changed, with one author comparing Christian captivity in North Africa to the horrors of the Stalinist Gulag, Stephen Klissel, another comparing privateers with terrorists, modern-day terrorists, Linda Colley, and yet another proclaiming that in the early modern period, over 1 million Christians were enslaved by Muslim masters, Robert Davis. This number appeared on the cover of the American edition, not the British, of one such book by Giles Milton, Black Gold, The Extraordinary Life of Thomas Pelham. You know, captivity was the plight, definitely, of men, women, and children who fell through the cracks of international piracy, conflict, and commerce. But how could a number like 1 million come up? This is how Davis, who kind of put to, you know, he was the one to put forward that number, and it stuck. How did he kind of explain it? And this is what he said in an interview. There are no records, of how many men, women, and children were enslaved, but it's possible to calculate roughly the number of fresh captives that would have been needed to keep populations steady and replace those slaves who died, escaped, or were ransomed, or converted to Islam. On this basis, it's thought that around 8,500 new slaves were needed annually to replenish numbers, and therefore he came up with 850,000, and then add a bit here and there, and you get the 1 million. Peter Earle, who studied Mediterranean captivity history in the early modern period, cast serious doubt on this number, as did Salvatore Bono, the kind of doyen of captivity studies in Italy. Neither, however, furnished a methodological argument with which to counter the numbers claimed by Davis. In order to focus on methodology, and this is really a paper about methodology, I will turn to Britain, which by the second half of the 17th century entered into rivalry with France over the control of the Mediterranean, beginning with the kind of 9 Years' War until Napoleonic Wars, kind of what one historian called the Hundred Years' War, the second Hundred Years' War between France and Britain. I will focus on its archive and with its extensive references to captives. My presentation will be divided in three parts. The first part is research and plan. This is my forthcoming study for a book. The second are the problems that we face, and then the conclusion and the proposed solution. The research plan. The research for this project started in 2001 in a very acrimonious meeting of the American Historical Association in Boston. It's the kind of thing that students like when two academics fight, and that's what happened. Although I looked into the archives in Morocco and Tunisia, I did not find the kind of information that was massively available at the National Archives at Kew, as well as at Oxford's Bodleian and the Devon Record Office. The richest was the compendium of documents and boxes of State Papers 71. And these are really amazing because there are thousands of papers that are still uncalendared. These boxes, you just open them, you don't know what's in them. That's a great thing that historians love. These boxes furnished me with the lion's share of information, although I found documents in many other places too, some where I absolutely never expected to, which was at the University of Minnesota, where I teach now. To count British captives is to face serious methodological challenges because no data about the number of English British captives were collected in a systematic fashion by either the ecclesiastical or the royal authorities in early modern Britain. Nor did the Admiralty ever assume responsibility for the captives of the merchant ships and so compiled no records. Although there were many lists of numbers and names of captives throughout the period under study, neither Lambeth or Whitehall or Westminster, established a uniform approach to count and record information about the captives. In France and Spain, the religious orders of the Mercedarians and Trinitarians kept record of captives and the numbers of men and women that were ransomed. That's why you can have very serious studies about numbers there. Later, they were joined by the Lazarites, who turned from helping the poor in the country to helping captives. Malta had a very carefully kept archive that it has enabled the study of Muslim captives, as Professor Wettinger has done, and converts to Islam, and thus extensive records as studied by Professor Chiapas. Italy, too, had its Inquisition, and thus extensive records as studied by Professor Salvatore Bono, while Portugal kept such careful records of North African captives that Ahmad Abu Sharab counted 9,287 Moroccans having been taken captive by the Portuguese alone from 1495 till 1541. Nothing like this systematic and continual record survives in the British archive. So the problems in the archive. The information about British captives survives in a wide range of documents, from private letters sent by captives to their families, to ship logs, church collections, women's petitions, royal or parliamentary appeals, and consular exchanges. There are also printed accounts about heroic escapes that sometimes approach the proto-novelistic narratives. Given personal interest, greed, and the political manipulation of the crisis of captivity by members of the trading companies who were in Parliament, the first methodological problem arises as such. How reliable are these diffuse sources about the number of captives? For instance, in April 1624, Parliament sought to raise money for the redemption, and this is a quote, of 15,000 English captives in Algiers under the Turks, end of quote, a number that could not have been remotely possible. On 3 October 1640, a petition was presented to King Charles on behalf of 3,000 captives in Algiers. But the appended sheet with the numbers of their men, the ships, who have been taken prisoners since May 18, 1639, gives the number as 937, but no names. Evidently, numbers were inflated, exaggerated, either out of ignorance for sensational effect, or because ransomers could skim money by receiving payment for non-existent captives, as numerous complaints about fraud demonstrate. A secondary question arises here as to whether there was a particular pattern to these exaggerations and whether they coincide with those years when there was disaffection with the Navy, the King, or the chartered companies, and thus inflating the numbers would embarrass and put pressure on the recalcitrant authorities. The above reference to 15,000 captives was made at a time of wide popular anger at the incompetence of the Admiralty after its botched attempt to bombard Algiers and liberate the captives there in 1621. At the same time, exaggerations were also marshaled by the newly established chartered companies to North America. There is enough evidence to show that exaggeration helped in scaring people off from North Africa. When the commercial and colonial project wanted to send settlers to North America to the plantations in Virginia, Newfoundland, and elsewhere. Initially, the Virginia enterprise, let us not forget, was disastrous, which is why the propaganda machinery of the chartered companies, often engined by clergymen, advertised to people the opportunities, riches, and grand future prospect that awaited them in the western plantations. Soon after the establishment of the Virginia Company in 1607, the promoters of colonialism desperately found themselves having to promote their projects after the numerous setbacks and to convince readers of the advantages of removal from England to North America. And for readers of Shakespeare's Tempest, Caliban is a very ideal figure in terms of kind of warding off any Mediterranean imagination towards North America. A second problem. Different numbers of captives were given by different sources about the same alleged captives. Was there a difference because one figure ignored the dead and the converted, while another did not? Or is it just that there was really no way of finding out the exact number, given the frequent dispersal of captives after their sale into various parts of the hinterland? In a report about expenses incurred in ransoming captives from Algiers in April 1645, numerous names of men are listed, along with the sums that they had borrowed from the ransomers and the captains. Next to their names, in a different hand, is added loss, the word lost. Actually, of the 16 men who borrowed money, 9 had been, quote-unquote, lost. This figure suggests more than the 17 to 20%, which scholars estimate is a mortality rate of European captives in North Africa. But there is already a problem here of crediting death to captivity. Early modern conditions at sea were quite dangerous, and ships lost large numbers of their crews to disease, scurvy, especially in the crossing to India, or at least on the kind of western coast, drowning and other mishaps. Not many Englishmen from a slum in London or a fishery in Portsmouth had enough stamina or physical fortitude to withstand the humidity of the Mediterranean or the scarcity of water on board ship or simply the change in temperature and environment and diet. Similarly, in a petition of 1665, the wives of captives mentioned the presence of 80 men in Algiers, but the petition included no more than a dozen names at the bottom. Were there 80 captives, or were there just 12 names that were listed? Would raising the figure to 80 attract more attention or shock the king more than a mere dozen? Also, a consul or a parliamentary report sometimes gives a round number, and these are the most kind of slippery, of let's say 3,000 or 5,200 captives. These figures are highly problematic because it's not possible to know how cumulative they are, whether they include earlier figures given by individual observers or whether they reflect a new influx of captives over and above the earlier figures. In the absence of named lists, it's not possible to reach a definite conclusion. Another problem arises when numbers are contrasted with the names of captives who are subsequently ransomed and verified by reference to the sum of money that was paid for their release. And this is, of course, not very, very common, but what you have on in the handout that I gave you is one of the few examples where we have the names of the captives, the cities from which they came, and actually the money, the amount of money that was paid for them. As a result, you can make the kind of map that I have prepared, but this is not very frequently available. If the names of captives who were ransomed are contrasted, for instance, with the thousands, the figure that you know, mentioned, that were mentioned in the 1641 Act, the conclusion will have to be that thousands of Britons never returned from North Africa, since the names were in the scores only. So you have this huge imbalance in numbers. Even a very small community like the Quakers, meticulous in recording names and locations of fellow co-religionists in North Africa, missed out on various names. So if thousands were ransomed, if thousands were captured at the time, you know, what happened to them? Where are they? If we have thousands being captured and very few lists of their names, what happened to them? Did they remain in North Africa? Did they convert? Did they die? Did they just integrate? That becomes a question. This is the problem that we face there. Other questions can be raised in this context. How many Britons deserted ship, whom captains falsely listed as captives? Are Britons who sought work among the Moors and were paid for it to be considered quote-unquote captives, given the official preference to list such men as captives because of the embarrassment about calling them employees of the Muslims? Many British soldiers were captured in battle, especially during the short-lived occupation of Tangier. As prisoners of war, these men had the option of negotiating ransoms just like captives seized by pirates and sold in the slave market. Were these prisoners of war or the captives of empire? And if there are thousands upon thousands of captives, why is it that there is not a single account of British captive rebellion or of mass escape in the manner that we see among Portuguese captives in Marrakesh or Muslim captives in Malta, the famous 1749 episode? Why is it that there is no reference to families of Britons being ransomed together, as in the case of North African, Spanish, or French captives? Is it possible that among the thousands upon thousands of British captives who are supposed to have been in chains, there were no women, no children, except the very, very few who are randomly mentioned in the course of the period under study? Finally, and given the ongoing stealing and buying and spiriting, the kind of technical term that was used, of children, did some end up in North Africa later to be termed captives? In these, during civil wars, there were lots of children just kind of spirited away. They were kind of stolen from the streets, put on ships, and basically shipped out, and nobody knows where. Were these captives? Conclusion and solution. These are some, and there are many, many more problems that I work with in the project for counting captives and evaluating, therefore, the kind of evaluations of historians, the accusations about the Gulag and the million. Giving out numbers is easy. Proving them is a different matter. So given the methodological problems, what is to be done? I propose to do what M. Lewis Coleman did regarding the English captives in the first century of North American colonization. Was captivity as widespread that it justified the destruction of the Indians, the captors? After all, from 1621 on, there was little attempt to cooperate with the Indians, as the Pequot War of 1637 and King Philip's War of 1676 show. For Coleman, the only way to measure the consequences of English captivity among the Indians and the impact on English theology and ideology was to count the captives. More specifically, the only way for arriving at a minimum but absolutely certain number was for her to list the names, to list all the names of the captives. In her book, New England Captives Carried to India, to Canada in 1925, Coleman listed the names of all captives between 1677 and 1760, concluding with a figure of 750 captives, or thereabouts. Her effort established the facts on the ground, or close to those facts, since, as another scholar, Richard Slotkin, observed, as he says, there is little doubt that this figure represents less than half of the total number of captives, end of quote. Even if Coleman's number is doubled, it still shows the scope of the English-Indian encounter. If 1,500 captives were seized, their impact on early New England American history could not have been equal if the number had been 5 or 10 times higher. Similarly, in the Mediterranean, if 500 seamen were taken captive, the effect on trade, investment, manpower, and shipping would be quite different from 5,000 or 50,000 or a million. Names would reveal how many members of the same family, for instance, nuclear or extended, often sailed together, or how many foreigners were working on English ships. Names will help in determining the sex of captives and the percentage of women and children. Names will show that whole families were rarely taken, unlike among the Muslims, as we said. Names will also furnish very verifiable evidence about the extent to which British ships were able to defend themselves, whether they were successful or unsuccessful, and the repercussions on trade in the Mediterranean, both with North Africa as well as with the Ottoman Empire. They will reveal the extent of British familiarity with North Africa and Islam, as returning captives told tales of wonder and horror. And again, this diagram will kind of show the concentration of returning captives, and therefore the information that, I mean, the stories that we would have told, in churches and pubs, where, you know, the first impression about the Muslim world for a large member, large parts of the community would have become available. Let us keep in mind that only in the Mediterranean, and because of captivity, Britons developed a hostile view of Islam, unlike their view of Islam in Persia or in India. Finally, numbers will show how only in England did captivity become a royal liability, leading in part to the fall of Charles I in 1649. Naming the captives entails a survey of as many sources as possible, with the full realization that there may always be other information that awaits investigation, and that every piece of evidence under examination could well have been exaggerated, edited, or changed. I suggest that every reference to captives and their names and numbers be entered into a chart. And that's what you have here, chart one. This is part of what I've been doing, basically every source that I've been able to find to put numbers, names and numbers. And that it be recognized that the only valid way to arrive at the minimum number of rich slaves in North Africa is to rely exclusively on documented names. And these documented names are as follows. Names that appeared on signed petitions submitted by the captives themselves or by their spouses or kinsmen. Names that were verifiably ransomed, of names of men, women and children who were ransomed, and they brought back kind of their certificate of ransom. Names that appeared on lists by British merchants, sea captains or government emissaries, or very rarely on lists by North African rulers who negotiated for their ransoms, and finally, names of escaped and returned captives to their parishes, and were mentioned specifically in published captivity accounts. Admittedly, these parameters will exclude many an unnamed captive. Also, whenever documents mention, quote-unquote, many captives, some captives, without specifying numbers or names, and although the captives need not be taken, need be taken account of, neither their number nor sex can be ascertained. Finally, unransomed captives will not be included. Given the policy of the Crown, rich Crown, not to ransom everyone, many captives were ignored, and their numbers, names, and place of origin completely ignored as well. So another chart, I will have another chart, other than the one with the name, the other one, the final one that you have, this one. This is basically to refer to every possible entry I have come across to captives. And therefore, what you will see is the year, the number of captives that are mentioned, now the number, as I say, without names, where they are, etc. So, I mean, we're going to have a very precise list and kind of the larger list. So, by counting captives with names, it will be possible to arrive at a bare minimum, but a minimum that is definite. And that minimum, as of now, which was when I prepared this paper in May, just last month, the number is 2,914. It's a far cry from the million, a number that was invoked in the journal Foreign Affairs, some of you may, after the seizure of a soldier in Afghanistan in 2006. From Morocco to Central Asia, from the 16th to the 21st centuries, captivity was, in the view of that journal article and its reference to the million, again, captivity was the only way in which Muslims dealt with the West. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Matar. One question that comes to mind, could it be that the discrepancy between numbers and names depends on the social standing of the persons, something maybe we can talk about later, that only the people who are actually important were mentioned by name? I don't know. So now we have Professor Godfrey Wettinger, who will be taking us back to the Middle Ages, to the 11th century, and I'm sure he will provide us, as usual, with some enthralling discoveries.
When I was contacted to take part today in what we're doing, my difficulty was that though I started studying slavery, and for about 10 years, early 60s, half a century ago, I was a slave to the slaves. Since then, however, I have drifted away from the slaves, and I haven't had time or opportunity, if you like, to keep up these studies, which I suppose is a pity. However, I have noticed only this morning I was serving on an MA examination viva on a thesis derived on a source I knew nothing about. And I discovered there is still stuff that is not open to research. For example, I'm not sure whether I am justified in saying this, but for about 200 years, here in Malta, our holy island, it was the habit to give the nuns of St. Ursula a little profit, a little amount of profit out of the profits of the corsairing expeditions. And apparently, that went on for about two centuries. I have discovered from serving on this viva, that those sources are not available for research. You have to ask whoever is in charge of St. Ursula's nuns, and I'm given to understand it is just about impossible. So there is still enough stuff for future researchers when I'm no longer here. But let me come closer now to my subject this evening. I agreed with those organizing, mainly down here, this thing, that the only thing I could talk which was new, unfortunately, I had got it wrong. And I am determined not to say that I made an agonizing reappraisal. Once is enough. So this time there are going to be no agonizing reappraisals, but it's going to amount to the same thing. Well, you would know that the first substantial historical text concerning the invasion of Malta by Count Roger, the one written by the Benedictine monk Geoffrey Malaterra, revealed the existence in Malta of a multitude of Christian captives who flocked out of Imdina, as we all know, greeting the normal count and waving crude crosses made out of palm fronds or scrap wood together, following which Count Roger and his Christian companions led them down to the ships moored or even beached near the shore. Though it was apparent even to 17th century Maltese readers that these captives were of foreign origin, nonetheless, you know, perception, how important it can be, even nowadays, everybody's telling us the perception is as important as the fact. The perception became that it was, in fact, the basis for the renewal of the pious tradition that there were people of local origin who were simply reduced to servitude by the Muslim rulers of the island in the High Middle Ages. Commendatore Abela, of whom you have heard, I'm sure, thought he was justified in conflating the bare facts as given by Malaterra by the addition of what he believed were reliable traditions. That word, remember. Of course, none of them recorded by Malaterra. Commendatore Abela could not but think that the Christian population surviving under Islamic rule were living in conditions close to slavery, eager for the liberty brought to them by Count Roger. The surprised delight of the foreign captives in 1091 was simply transferred, to a large extent, to non-existent local Christian population. Malta, in Count Roger's time, had a really existing foreign captive population, apparently of some size, and an imaginary one representing the non-existent descendants of the survivors of the massacres and exilings that happened round about 870 AD. This was being written by Commendatore Abela and others, and even before him, in the middle years of the 17th century, when Malta had a constant foreign slave population of several thousands, most of them Muslims, with just a sprinkling of Jews and a few scores of so-called renegades or ex-Christians captured while fighting on the Muslim side. That there must have been an unclear number of indigenous Christians living in conditions close to those of slavery did not rouse any doubt, since it was considered the inevitable fate of Christians living in a Muslim environment. Curiously enough, however, Abela himself was aware that there were non-slave Christians living in various parts of Greece, of the Morea, and elsewhere. That explains why he accepted the idea that, in addition to the foreign slaves in Malta, there were Maltese Christians living apparently relatively freely in places like Wirtrum, who did not want to leave the island on Count Roger's ships like the others did. Anyhow, Abela's critical spirit was particularly aroused by Malaterra's statement that the Saracens of Malta were not at all warlike, that they were terrified by seeing the Count and his Normans actually on the island. I had never read that before, that Abela himself was surprised at the peaceful nature of the Maltese. Such a large number of foreign captives, according to Abela, must indicate that the Saracens in Malta must have counted amongst themselves a sizable number of corsairs well used to the fiercest of warlike combat. Of course, on this one, he was correct. We have now known, ever since the time when the great Sicilian historian Michele Amari told us about the short passage in Al-Azwini's writings, that when the Muslims populated Malta in the middle years of the 11th century, the Muslims consisted of free men, or hurra, and abida, or slaves. Their existence would not have surprised Abela at all, had he lived in Amari's time, though it is unlikely he would have understood for some time precisely who the abida were. For him, as for the Maltese contemporaries of Michele Amari himself, the abida must have been slaves, no more and no less, and probably descendants of the survivors of 870 AD. But they were slaves with a difference, and people didn't notice the difference. Normally, in the 10th century or thereabouts, abida started off as slaves, but still, in their youth, they would have been taken over by one of the main authorities in the land, like an emir of Tunisia, and trained as professional soldiers. Such professional slave soldiers could be found in most countries throughout Islam. Frequently, they were obtained as children from abroad. The Ottomans had their Janissaries, well known in Malta, both as redoubtable opponents on the battlefield and as truculent captives among the slaves. And the Fatimids in Egypt had their Mamluks, who survived as an institution there throughout the late Middle Ages and well into the 19th century. Amari himself seems to have misled his Maltese contemporaries, who were delighted by the opportunity to be misled, by speaking of a combined Maltese population of Hurra and Abida, leading to the idea, because they were fighting against the invaders, the Greeks, that the Abida slaves, who were descendants, were slaves, descendants of the Maltese Christians who had survived the massacres of 870 AD. So they needn't worry about the captivity any longer now. They had others from documented from the Muslim side. However, we know that they were military slaves who gave an excellent account of themselves in the fighting with the Byzantine invaders that occurred circa 1050s, 50-55 or whatever. And according to the Muslim chroniclers, and they marched and they dashed towards them, knocking them down with their lances and piercing them with their swords without fear or favor, sure of one of two things, either speedy success or the triumph of death. God, the Exalted, provided them with help, giving out patience to them and alarm to their enemies. Their behavior convinced me when I was writing The Arabs in Malta in 1984 and 86 that they were undoubtedly Muslims by the time of that fighting, whatever their ancestry. And at that time, I was still open to the idea that possibly they were descendants of survivors. On the other hand, the lengthy negotiations of the Hurra, of the free people, with the Abida, had possibly an unfortunate effect on me. That's the closest I'm going to get to having that sort of apology. Did one have to negotiate with military slaves who were also subject to military discipline? I therefore came out, unfortunately, with the idea that there were no military slaves in Malta. And about the negotiations, this is what we read from a Muslim source. The Hurra, therefore, gathered them together and told them, if you are faithful to us in the battle and follow us in our fate and finish where we finish, you shall be set free and join us, and we shall give you our daughters in marriage to you and share our wealth with you. But if you temporize and leave us in the lurch, you shall attain captivity and the same bondage as ourselves. You shall be worse in your situation than we shall be, since in our case one may be redeemed by an intimate friend or freed from captivity by his governor or his community will sustain his rescue. And I therefore decided, unfortunately, that they could not have been military slaves. And I only noticed while preparing this paper that I had bungled it. In some editions, the second edition of Arabs in Malta, I referred to a book I had just bought about military slavery and so on. You'll find it. I've forgotten to put it down here. I'm sorry. That is what I wrote at the end of the second edition of Arabs in Malta in 1986, citing the best book on the subject, which I had just bought. However, things have changed now. Within the last 2 or 3 months, a book came out by an American of Sicilian descent who tells us that the Idrisids of Tunisia sent a large army to Malta in 1040. The possibility that the Abida came precisely with that army, in fact, the probability that they were originally part of that army, changes the matter completely. Now we know they must have been Abida. All that business and argumentation, which is dangerous for historians, that's called speculative parts of history. That's where you slip up so easily, even when you've got a lifetime of experience, changes the matter completely. Just to think about it, how could we have had Abida when, as far as we could tell, the first people, Muslims, coming to Malta after 870 and a century only of donkeys, goats and sheep, how could we account for the coming of Abida to defend the shepherds and farmers? But now that we know that the Idrisids actually sent us a large army, that army itself, largely, I'm adding here, I'm speculating again. You know, it's one of the habits of any historian, I suppose, must have considered of Abida and nothing else. Oh, and amongst others, Abida. That they subsequently resorted to corsairing activity is also well within the bounds of probability. I mean, what would Abida normally do in the normal peacetime in those days? You've got excellent harbors. Somehow they obtained the timber. They could get capture ships and re-equip them and use them. And there is some evidence they were highly successful. They started off from that date onwards, newly married. By the way, the Abida, I should have said here, that the Abida resembled the Fatimids in Egypt. And I think I've mentioned them. And the Janissaries in the Turkish Empire, if you want to call it Turkish. And after the defeat and repulsion of the Byzantine army, what could they do in normal peace, a relative peacetime situation? Excellent harbors. They were military slaves, well-trained. And that explains why they fought so well against the Byzantines. They were not domestic slaves. Once you make that mistake, even in translation, they spoke to their slaves. Abida could not have been their slaves. Abida would have been slaves of the Amir, of the government. And they just used their vessels They used the harbors, great success. And when Count Roger arrived, 30 or 40 years later, Abela was surprised at the large number of captivi we had in the harbor. And here, we are talking of two types of slaves. Captivi, obviously captured civilians, and Abida, trained military slaves. But the Abida were the jailers and captors of the others. That's the big difference, and we cannot confuse the two. And if you say, what right do you have to distinguish? I'll say, is the right of historical judgment. Sorry, if you don't like it. Yes, those people of Imdina who confessed their peaceful nature and their inability to resist the normal invasion were speaking truthfully. They were mainly descendants, children or grandchildren, of refugees from the Bedouin invaders, newly out of Arabia, uncultured people who were harrying a lot of the towns of North Africa. With them there must have been a number of farmers and shepherds who crossed over from Sicily, as I have tried to indicate in the paper published recently, Melita Storica. You may agree with that, you may not. But if you don't, you have to give another plausible account. And I'll hold you to that. And all this explains the languid way in which they confronted Count Roger and his army. Of course, one asks, what had become of the corsairs themselves in 1091? If they were military slaves and fought so well in the 1050s, why did they not fight so well in the 1090s? Well, you've got an example in front of you. 40 years make an impression on people. They must have had, with the help of the daughters of the Hurra, descendants, but their training may not have been so good. But there is another explanation, much more plausible. Malta, then like now, was only 1 or 2 days distance, even without steam power or whatever power ships use nowadays, to cross over from Malta to Sicily and vice versa. They would have had ample time to get to know of the great preparations being made by Count Roger in Sicily. As they had the ships, the only thing they need worry about was whether to take their wife with them. So they had ample time to sail away. And Count Roger was confronted only by children of refugees, ex-farmers and ex-shepherds, and perhaps some of the old men. And therefore, he had no trouble in taking the island and helping himself to the booty of the corsairs. However, now there's another point. I have been talking of, the last 20 years, the pact between the Hurra and the Abida. And we have understood that pact as an agreement between slave owners and their slaves. But it's not like that now. By the new interpretation, the Hurra were not the slave owners of the Abida. The Abida belonged to the Emir. And the pact between the two was much closer to a pact between two sections, separate sections of the population. And that makes the whole thing much more understandable. And that's all. Malta must have had three sources of Muslim repopulation. Possibly a little bit of Christians can be allowed in, if you don't mind. But Muslims, three types. Farmers and shepherds from Sicily, refugees from the towns on the shore of Tunisia, like Susa. What was her name? That the one with the gravestone. Maimuna. Maimuna. She came from her family came from Susa. One of those. What you call him? A poet's family was connected to Susa as well. So it all ties up. And the result was almost solidly Muslim population. Christians, very little. Otherwise, we would have heard of them. In place names, yes, one or two. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Professor Wettinger. I think very interesting, stimulating talk. So this, I mean, what you've been saying would confirm, therefore, Al-Himyari's account. It would confirm Al-Himyari's account that Malta was populated really after 1040-48.
Yes.
Yes. So well, that.
After 1000.
40-48.
Yes. Le.
Anyway, we can have this in the discussion because I'm sure that there will be people
who would be.
No.
Okay. That was the second wave.
Okay.
The first wave seems to have started with the farmers, and the shepherds. And that might take it back another 50 years.
Okay, so we'll open the floor to the people here. Yes? Yes, of course.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to listen to Professor Wittinger, so salutation. And of course, welcome to Professor Nabil. I've heard some figures spread around the interesting talks we had. Do you want me to scream more? Yes. So, do we have any numbers? How much was the slave trade worth? How much, what importance was it for the Maltese economy and the North African economies? Was it that important? Was it part of the so-called world trade at the time? Thank you.
I can say this. I have my hands tied behind me because I have to rely on documentation. The only document about that is a coin recently discovered, a gold coin, precisely at the time when the Abida were probably resorting to slave the capture of civilians abroad. Abroad where? Probably from the Greek world in South Italy or from some parts of Sicily.
but I would prefer another coin to be found and placed near the other one, so that we'll be seeing it on both sides. And they will keep each other company. Having only one coin, I am not yet convinced.
I have a question for Professor Wettinger. The theory about, you know, your analogy with the Janissaries and the Mamluks.
Oh, those are two different.
I know, but that's also very, very late.
Huh?
That's very late.
Late in time.
No. Yes, that they persisted down to there.
I know.
But some of them are before.
Yes, but I mean the Janissaries begin in the, what, 15th century, the Mamluks
beginning
in the 13th
century.
Yes,
yeah,
so I mean, can you draw the analogy with a group before that?
Yes, because studies have been made. A book came out precisely on that matter. In addition, if one studies references to Abida in a book by Muhammad Talbi, I think his name is, you'll discover that every time he tells you, these were normally mercenary soldiers or slaves in the 11th and 10th centuries.
Okay, I would like to ask a question to Dr. Shapara, please. Did I hear you right when you said that apostates used to justify themselves by saying they were seduced?
Seduced by the concubine.
They were seduced?
Yes, there are some examples.
And how did this justification, and how was this justification taken by the authorities?
First of all, this is what some of the apostates said, that they were seduced by the concubines, you see? And then the other question is, what did the Inquisitor say?
Yeah, what did the Inquisitor say when this justification was brought up?
The most important part of my talk was this, that the Inquisitor was very lenient. That is, most of them were vehemently suspect of apostasy. They were not truly heretics. They were not truly Muslims. You see? That is, he closed one eye. In fact, in the sentence, he used to say, come dicesti. This is what you say. I cannot verify it. You see? But perhaps you didn't want to become a Muslim. In your heart of hearts, you remained a Christian. But outwardly, you became a Muslim. You see? And that was enough for the Inquisitor not to condemn them as formal heretics, but as suspect of apostasy. You see? That was it.
How did the apostolates find their way to Malta? I mean, were they recaptured, ransomed, or did they return of their own free will by escaping? Because that would shed light as to their true conviction with regards to being
Muslim. Some of them did escape. Some of them did escape, and some Christians escaped from Malta to North Africa. Others were captured, you see. There were several examples of them, you see. Others were redeemed. But most of the cases I mentioned were, they either returned on their own, that is, they escaped, various examples of them, or else they were found as slaves on coastal ships, when the ships were caught by the Christian ships.
Just a statement to confirm with Professor Wettinger. So the only foreign Christians, the only Christians who were foreign, found in 1091 by Count Roger, were the captivi.
There are two phases in my thinking on that. Before we got to know by that book by Carielli that an army arrived here 1040 and refugees also arrived here round about 1050. The only information then we had related to possibly farmers and shepherds. and that these probably came over from Sicily. At that stage, I thought, we don't have to worry about Christians coming over. However, with the situation as it has developed now, with Malta now, we have to agree having three sources for its population. We do not have to keep on insisting that those who came from Sicily must have been Muslims. There could have been a few Christians among them. Why not? But you have to respect one fact. One fact that we know it on the authority of one of the best geographers of the 10th century, namely Ibn Hawal, that I'm adding the word unfortunately, Malta only had donkeys, sheep and goats. That's it. Now, however, with the new situation, you've got Abida. Definitely they would have possibly started off as Christians in their early years. Then they were dragooned into becoming Muslims, giving military discipline and training. So you got plenty of Muslims. You got the refugees from the seaports of Tunisia. Definitely just about all of those would have been Muslims. Why worry about allowing an occasional Christian coming over from Sicily as well?
I have two books in the Moriscos, and what the number you and the number you explained about the number of captives, was it for England only, or was it, you know, for all, for everybody, and how long was it? Does it cover the three centuries that the this activity took place?
Yeah, the numbers I'm working with are completely British. I mean, the archive is British, although, as I say, it could be found elsewhere. So, yes, my figures are basically going to focus on Britain exclusively. The reason is that other people have done work. Salvatore Bono has done amazing work on Italy. Professor Wettinger has done it on Malta. Gillian Weiss very recently has done a magnificent study on Christian captives in French Christian captives. So in a sense, now I'm glad we're seeing the past kind of decade, a more serious, methodologically more serious approach to the study of captives, their numbers, their backgrounds, and their kind of configurations. So I'm working, as I say, with that. Now with the Italian archive, which is what Richard Davis worked, I have not worked with that, but I know that Salvatore Bono, who is really the doyen, he gave a lecture in which he basically came down on the arguments and the methodologies of Davis. So in terms of that archive, which I have not worked with, I'm, you know, deferring to Salvatore Bono. The reason I'm focusing on England, however, I think is, in my view, very significant because of the fact that by the second half of the 17th century, Britain and France would dominate the Mediterranean. And in a sense, they're the traders, they're the sailors, they have the fleets, and therefore the manpower and the presence in the Mediterranean that now Spain will begin basically to lose or has already lost. The Italians have already lost. The Dutch have been thrown out. And that's why, in a sense, when I find it extremely problematic when somebody says, you know, with these numbers, because Britain and France now dominate the Mediterranean. I mean, they blow up, they destroy all the North African coasts. I mean, whether it is Algiers, whether it's Tripoli, whether it's Tunis, whether it's Saleh, all these, which had been, quote-unquote, nests of pirates, were destroyed. And even in the process of destruction was not just the quote-unquote piratical fleet, but also the commercial fleet. I mean, that's why the North Africans completely lost the maritime trade. I mean, they were very eager to get involved. They wanted to trade in the same way that the British and the French and the Maltese and the Spaniards, everybody. But from basically from the 1670s, the French introduced a new maritime technology, which was a development of the long-range cannon, which meant that they could basically moor their ships at a certain distance from, as they did, from Algiers, and bomb it with completely no repercussion. I mean, the Algerians could not hit back. And that is then picked up by the British, who will do the same to Tripoli and then to Tunis. And by the end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, I mean, the fleets are minimal now. I mean, they've lost everything. And I've done a different research on numbers of ships. And in the middle of the 17th century, for instance, Algiers had around 65 ships, which some of them were very, very large ships, around 5,000 tons. I mean, they were huge ships. By the beginning of the 18th century, they had 10 ships, and they're very 10. And the smallest port in the North African region was Libya, was Tripoli. And again, the numbers that I found, I mean, in the kind of middle of the 17th century, they maybe had like 17 or 18 ships, a very, very small port. By the beginning of the 18th century, there's nothing. I mean, they're just kind of, you know, small frigates, and that was it. The British and the French have destroyed their infrastructure, and now whatever trade they wanted to carry out, whatever, if they wanted to go on pilgrimage, if they wanted to travel to Istanbul, they basically now would have to board French or British ships. Now, the Dutch kind of continued a little bit until the end of the century, by which time they're thrown out. The Italians have lost. The Spaniards are completely cut off because of their historic enmity with the Ottomans. And so, you know, in a sense, it ends the piracy of the Mediterranean. I mean, it continues on a very, very small scale, but nothing significant. And yet, it is used, I mean, not just in the modern time, but in the, you know, in the 19th century. I mean, France uses that argument to attack and occupy Algeria. Britain also attacks Algiers in 1816. So, I mean, it's, you know, it becomes a casus belli for the kind of infractions that wanted. But the ultimate goal was control. I mean, they controlled the Mediterranean and ended up by dominating commerce, dominating navigation, and cutting off completely the North Africans. Yes,
Professor Whittinger wants to add something? Or?
Just one thing. I was asked about whether there were any of these Christians, early Christians. For 100 years, there were donkeys. And as far as I know, they cannot be Christian. But I have my doubts sometimes. I can risk my position further. I'm always doing that. I do not keep my reticence and hide my arguments. I bring them out in the open. One candidate of an early Christian post 10th century, probably post 10th century, would be the place name Eriesheim. Eriesheim seems to have been Gerasimu. Eriesheim Gerasimu. Think of it. Gerasimu is a very normal, very common name in the Greek culture, even in Russia nowadays. Gerasimu.
My question is for Dr. Mario Gallia. It seems that the first Maltese authors were reflecting the public attitude towards the Turk. But could they avoid having such an attitude? And were they highlighting this attitude even further through literature and drama? Or is it, could they have observed another attitude amongst the Maltese, which they did not include by choice?
I think basically
This attitude is not only observed, it's being created by people like Muscazzo Pardi. I think he helped create this mentality of us and the others because it served his purpose, it served his politics in the sense that he needed to show his compatriots, he needed to show the British that we stand here, but we're European, so there should be no ambiguity about that. So the best way to do it would be to antagonize or show us as enemies of all Muslims. I think one of the examples I've seen from this period of someone giving a slightly different picture would be Manuel de Mec. There are instances in his newspaper where he documents Turks being in Malta and tries to create some kind of empathy with them. They're here as migrants, they're here as workers, and we should treat them with some dignity. But I think the issue is that Muscazzo Pardi's vision was the dominant vision, or at least it became the dominant vision throughout Romanticism and throughout our history of nationalism as well.
If I may add a little thing on this, because I've worked also on the subject, I think this goes very much in the trend also of Italian romantic literature, where you have Rimori, Saraceni, who are always the bad guys, and Christians are always the good guys, so that it ended. But as regards what you were saying about somebody treating in a different way, the first one was Gianton Vassallo, actually, who was one of the ones who treated them as clip, etc., in his poetry. But then in a couple of poems, he starts saying, "Ma damuj bled bilpalna, why prisa prisa? Why should we capture them? And they are human beings like us." So there are these little trends, but I think they were a minority within the whole spectrum.
It makes sense in the sense that Vassallo was writing almost exactly after the abolition of slavery, so he would have sort of been sensitive to the politics of.
My question is to Professor Wattinger. If we to take Ibn Hawqal's description as a matter of fact, so how would the story of St. Paul coming to Malta would relate on all of this? I mean, there seems to be.
Facts are facts. And history is built on documentation. I'm a historian, and I have to accept the documentation as it is. Ibn Hawqal tells us we have three types of animals, donkeys, sheep, and goats. And, by the way, he could have said bees as well. Perhaps in people's bonnets, that's where they've remained, the bees. Ibn Hawqal has the greatest reputation on one side and a questionable reputation on the other side. As a geographer, he has the greatest reputation for precision. Precision by the standards of those days. As a describer of people, he was a Muslim. He could have been a Christian, but he was a Muslim. And he belonged to one of the Muslim sects. I think it was a Shiite. And therefore, anything the Sunnis did was wrong. He belabored the Sicilians for eating too many onions, which spoiled their judgment, and so on. All right, that was his failing. But as a geographer, he is greatly admired and has been admired For the last several centuries, the last two books that have just come out, Carielli and another book, Alvin told me about it and I bought it and it arrived 2 or 3 days ago, both give prominence to Ibn Hawar. I mean, what more can you do?
So thank you very much. I think we have to close down because we have to close down the hall. So maybe we can talk maybe outside. We have all the time maybe to Professor Oettinger. So I would like to thank you all for coming. I would like to thank Professor Matar for being here with us. Our three Maltese, Professor Oettinger, Professor Ciappara, and Dr. Gallia. I think the level of the discussion was so high, we have improved since the times of the donkeys, goats, and sheep. And I must also thank from the tech, first of all, Dr. Adrian Grima, who was the mind and everything behind this, and Dr. Bernard Mikalev, the head of the Maltese department, and the technical aspect, Lara Spiteri Fondacaro, who is the secretary of the Maltese department, Joseph Mitzi of Mitzi Books, Mr. Alex Baramki, thank you for all your help, and last but not least, Samuel Attard from Campus FM, who has done all the recording and technical work.